This is the NCARB podcast, where you get an inside look at licensure, regulation, and the initiatives shaping the future of architectural practice. I'm your host, Andy McIntyre, Vice President of Marketing and Communications at NCARB. And this season, we're diving into Pathways to Practice, NCARB's multi-year effort to rethink how architects become licensed.
Architecture is the hardware to the software of life, right? It is fundamentally about that interaction, and it makes life easier if we have a built environment that works.
Across 8 episodes, we'll explore how licensure got to where it is today and where it needs to go next. We talk with architects, educators, regulators, and NCARB leaders about education, experience, and the exam, and why each of those pillars is evolving.
And that portion of school where you go from conceptual to real is also really challenging. It's not something you're really gently moved into. It's kind of like you're doing something that's flowy and crazy, and all of a sudden, wait, you actually have to make this work.
You'll hear how the NCARB competency standard was developed, how research is shaping future licensure models, and what a more flexible, competency-based approach could mean for candidates from a wide range of backgrounds.
So we've seen that in our data as the number of reciprocal licenses starts to decrease a little bit, but that number of individuals who are licensed holds steady.
We also tackle the big questions. Why does licensure look the way it does today? Where do candidates face the biggest barriers? And how can we expand access without lowering standards?
Not everybody fits into the same mold. And so having different pathways to licensure, I think, is really important.
Whether you're a licensure candidate, an educator, a firm leader, or a regulator, this season offers clarity, context, and transparency into one of the most important conversations facing the profession.
Does this requirement to complete all divisions of the exam place an unfair burden on any one group or other?
This is Pathways to Practice, only on the NCARB podcast. Please follow the link in the show notes, subscribe now, and join us as we explore the future of architectural licensure.
In the 1940s, Lizzie worked on...
Lizzie,
yes.
Oh, Lizzie traveled back in time.
Yes, I did. I was alive in the 1940s.
Wow, what's your secret?
You look good.
Thank you. Thank you. My skincare routine.
Oh, luck.
Welcome to Season 11 of She Builds Podcast, where we share stories about women in the design and construction field, one lady at a time.
This season, we were inspired by the number 11, which is basically a pair of ones. So this season's theme is pairs or duos. We are talking about ladies who are just a part of a professional pair in some fashion.
As always, we are not experts. We are just sharing stories about the information that we find, as friends having a fun conversation. If you find an error, send us an email and we will all continue learning together.
Today, we're talking about Lillian Swan Saarinen, the sculptor of iconic architecture projects. I'm Nurjeri Rivas, wondering how many days I will live without electricity in 2024 in Houston, Texas.
Hey, I'm Jessica Rogers, living in constant heat and humidity, based out of Miami, Florida.
And I'm Lizzie Rahr, playing the game of will he, won't he with Carl in San Francisco.
Ooh.
So this story was really interesting because I found an oral history. Lillian was interviewed in a series that lasted years, and I found the transcripts.
I've had that before with a few ladies. It's kind of awesome and also kind of overwhelming trying to piece it all together and not have a 2 to 3 hour episode.
Honestly.
Same. And then you're so excited to hear this lady tell her story in her own words, but at the same time, you just want to get to the root of the plot. Not so much about the weather or like what she was wearing. And then because it's an oral history, you find yourself wanting to ask follow-up questions, but you can't because it's recorded years ago.
And sometimes it's not fully in order. You know, they come back to things and yeah.
Tangents and just...
I mean, it's riveting.
It's great. Not good for research.
All the things. It is good for research, yeah.
Too good.
Too good. Not for a 30-minute episode, though.
All right. With that introduction, let's do it to it. The time, April 17, 1912. The place, New York City. Lillian Louisa Swan was born. Her parents were Dr. Arthur Wharton Swan and Susan Ridley Sedgwick. Lillian had a sister 2 years her senior, Lucy. So it was Lucy and Lillian. I just think it's so cute when siblings have the same initials.
Very cute.
It is cute.
Lily says the family was part of society, but not really wealthy. Her mom was a socialite and her dad was a doctor. Sadly, he passed away when she was only 2 years old.
Oh, no.
Oh, wow.
Even though she was so young, she remembers that all of a sudden her dad was gone. Mom was dressed in black for a long time. For a while, she left to California, mom, to get away, and the girls stayed behind with British nanny. It was really confusing and traumatic for her as a child.
Mm. I bet. That would be so confusing and a lot to take in as a kid. I mean, dad dying or disappearing alone is traumatic, but then to have mom leave too, and she probably didn't know if she was coming back or not. Mm. Like, ooh.
That part. Having mom leave like that, I wonder what kind of grief that mother went through to have want to go to California without her kids.
Agreed.
Yeah. Well, after that, Lily had interesting formative years. She loved drawing animals. She was super into biology, zoology, physiology. She went to a good school, Miss Chapin's school in Manhattan, but she was not a fan because they made her do a lot of still lives and she would get good grades. But to her, that wasn't art because it didn't mean anything to her, you know?
I get the still lives. I've drawn my fair share of still lives and it can get so monotonous. Guessing the time, though, I doubt that the school allowed for any hint of the outside of the norm type of art.
Yeah. And her mom, even though that really traumatic thing happened very early on, the mom really loved her daughter. And eventually she came back and she really tried to nurture her daughter's art passion. She gave the okay for teenage Lily to go live with the art tutor, Miss Louise Saunders, during school breaks. And Miss Louise taught Lily about whatever Lily was interested in. So she learned mostly about history of art and sculpture.
Well, it sounds like that was probably a better way for her to learn since she got to choose the curriculum and direction of what she learned. I also appreciate that her mom was like, okay, we need to figure something out and didn't just say, well, you can opt out of school. Because I feel like at this time that might have happened, you know?
Mm-hmm. Probably. All right, and this Miss Louise sounds interesting, though. Like, so she can just tutor Lily on any art-related subject? What is her life? How can she do that? But for Lily, she likes art enough for her to continue to doing it, even between semesters? I don't know. That sounds fun. I did that a little bit.
And she was constantly drawing. She liked going to Central Park to draw, or going to the Met or the Museum of Science. Her mom tried to take her to one of these at least once a week so that Lily could get her art drawing fix. Okay, it sounds like mom really tried to nurture her daughter's interests and talents, and that could not have been easy as a widow. So I have a really soft spot for mom.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and this is a great mom trying to make sure that her daughter was intellectually and artistically stimulated. I love it.
Yes. Hi, mom.
At 17, she became a pupil of Alexander Archipenko, a famous Ukrainian-American artist and sculptor. The entrance exam to get into his class consisted of copying one of his drawings displayed on a wall. She drew a simple line drawing, and that really impressed him. It showcased her inherent form in line alone. Recognizing her talent as a sculptor, just off of that, he placed her in the top class, making her one of the youngest students he ever had.
Woo! Way to go, Lily.
Ooh, very cool.
Alexander ended up being a very good and encouraging teacher. She would draw different still lives and then sculpt abstractions.
Nice.
This sounds like such a great opportunity for her.
Yeah, and finally, the still lives took more meaning. So I like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
She lived for a while in Connecticut at a farm with another famous sculptor, Heinz Warnecke. Lily just traveled around studying art under these famous people. It sounds like an artist thing to do. Like, normal people do not do this.
It is such an artist thing to do, like travel around, apprentice, collaborate with various people, you know.
But that's so cool.
Well, yeah. But just all like right. Norjiti said, normal people don't do that.
Yeah.
Jessica's living vicariously through Lily right now.
Mm-hmm.
That's right.
Wish I could be her.
Okay. Also, very artist thing to do. She had a few of her drawings be a part of exhibitions in galleries in New York. Just that like 17, 18-year-old Lily and her little artist self getting on exhibitions.
Whoa, that's crazy. I mean, good for her.
Hey, wild indeed. But when you're that good, it also seems like she was just in the right artist circles to have all of these connections.
Yeah, for sure.
Okay, this is going to be a little random, but listen to this. At 18, she went to Munich to study sculpture, and someone told her she should go skiing in Austria. And she was like, I think there will be nature and animals there. So, yeah, let's go. By now, you know that this is her jam. She's just like, okay, let's do it.
I'm not sure where skiing and sculpture intersect, but sure, why not?
Yeah, like, sure, let's go skiing in Austria.
Turns out she really likes skiing because to her it was like an art, like sculpting.
What?
She thought that the two were similar. Yep, that's what she said.
Okay.
And casually, as this lady does absolutely everything, she's like, oh snap, I'm pretty good at this. So she got trained by important athletes, which we're not going to mention because we'll be here all day, and became an alternate on the first U.S. women's alpine ski team at the 1936 Winter Olympics.
Stop. What? That is not a casual endeavor.
Nope.
How does someone casually join an Olympic team?
Yeah, that does not happen.
Just like that. Okay, there's absolutely nothing casual about this lady, all right? She feels like the protagonist of a show on TV that does everything well.
I love all of this. And the fact that in her retelling, she's like, oh, yeah. And then I went to be an alternate for the Olympics. I thought it would be cool.
Honestly, that's the life I would want to live. You know, just chasing opportunities as they come. Also, this is happening in her, like, early 20s. How wild.
That's right. And don't think she just left her art aside. No, 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 no. She kept drawing at night. She would train during the day, draw at night. She was intense.
Yeah, no kidding.
I mean, maybe drawing was how she, like, unwind from all of her activities.
Well, yeah, maybe.
Maybe, yeah. After 1936, she left Europe, went back to New York. There, she was trying to figure out what's next. And a friend recommended she went to Cranbrook because it was a place where famous artists taught and she could be completely free. And Lily thought, oh, yeah, that's it.
This lady is great. She's just flitting from thing to thing, but also killing it everywhere she goes. Like,
why not?
Sure.
As she's considering going to Cranbrook, she went to a lecture of one of its professors and master architect of the place, guess who? Eliel Saarinen. And she was really captivated by his words, how he spoke about nature, architecture, and city planning. I like this quote he told the class. If you're going to do an ashtray, you have to know what table it's going to be on. And if you're going to do a table, you have to know what kind of room it's going to be in. And if you're going to do a room, you have to know what kind of house it's going to be in. You have to always think of the next largest apply. You have to always think of the next largest thing to what you're commissioned to do. About this, Lily said, I never forgot that because it applied to a lot when I was doing my sculpture.
Sorry.
I did a good job.
Very firm.
The Eliel voice was really getting me.
Commission to do.
That's how I imagine him.
Finnish man?
Yeah.
I think so.
That is a really good way to think about design. Essentially, context, right?
Yes. Now, we briefly mentioned this when talking about Loya Saarinen, Eliel's wife. It's context, like you said, Lizzie. But I think when we think of context, we might think from the top down. Like, we design the building, then think of the room, then the chair and the fabric. Eliel is thinking the opposite.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, context is everything, right? So for Lily, that lecture from Eliel opened her eyes to the possibilities of her sculptures and started getting her to think about architecture sculptures. And during the talk, he mentioned his son was studying city planning, and her ears perked up when she heard, "My son."
I bet they did.
Ooh.
So she ends up going to Cranbrook, studying under Carl Miele, just another very famous artist, and learning more about materials, how she should treat each through different techniques and her sculptures. He gave her really good critiques, and she took them to heart.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it sounds like it was really informative to her work.
It was. One night, she goes out to dinner with friends, and there is Eliel Saarinen's son, Arrow. Mm-hmm. And she asked him, when did he arrive to the U.S.? And he was like, why do you ask? In an accent that I can't do. And she said, because your accent is so thick. And he was like, that's offensive. But I like skiing and you're an Olympian. So I'm going to ignore that you said that. And we're going to talk about absolutely anything else. So they did. And they started to dig each other.
I mean, what a meet cute.
That's actually really funny. In Miami, it's so common to ask someone about their accent.
Oh,
really?
Yeah, because everyone has an accent. So it's like, oh, where are you from? I guess not in Michigan.
But are they asking how long have you been here?
Sometimes, but they still don't find it. Again, everyone immigrates to Miami, especially if you have an accent that thick. So
she was in awe of him. And he was really impressed with her work. It was mutual. They liked each other. He asked her to develop the sculpture for a civil center he was doing in Flint, Michigan. It was her first big architectural commission. There, she began to put into practice what she'd been learning from Eliel and Carl, how sculpture has to relate to architecture.
Yay! I'm excited that she got her first commission.
Yeah! Woo.
Arrow asked her to finish a pillar he had designed for the space, and she started out by thinking that it was a civic community center. Children would go there, and she decided to sculpt animals climbing on up to the pillar. She made raccoons, bears, and animals that were local to the region. Thinking about the use, the context of the space, the scale, all these architectural modes of thinking, don't you think?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I like how she thought about the design for this. It sounds like she's taking Eliel's advice to heart.
Yep.
Air was pretty happy with what she produced, which made her happy. Then his sister, Pipsen, commissioned her to do a sculpture of dragons for niches in their house, which was another big commission.
Making those connections.
Yeah. Like we mentioned last week, that family was so talented. I feel like if one person liked you, then you were in.
That's nice. The parameters Pipsum gave her were, do whatever you want, just as long as it's wild. So Lily experimented with busy form and busy color, which was innately very dangerous and wild. She started to learn how to deal with colors in sculptures. She would go to the pottery department and get suggestions and critiques from the pottery students. It was a whole thing.
Color being dangerous and wild. I like that she also sought out help to get ideas and feedback, but it also seems like that was like the Cranbrook environment.
Yeah. That's a crazy brief for a project. I think I would be overwhelmed with like the possibilities. I like having some parameters for a project.
Same. But Lily handled it. She started collaborating more and more with Arrow, spending time with the Saarinens, getting to work on more architectural sculptures. I can't tell when Arrow and Lillian started dating, but I can tell you that she was scared of mom. Mama Saarinen to Lily was very rigid, but she got along with everyone else.
Loya was the only one she couldn't crack, I guess.
Well, if you recall last week when we talked about Loya, she was the matriarch that was looking after everything. Like, I mean, I would be intimidated by Loya.
Yeah, scary stuff.
True.
While Lily was working with Arrow, reviewing his designs, sharing her general intuition about the spaces, and he trusted her judgment.
That's right.
That's actually really cute. It reminds me of Loya and Eliel.
When Arrow started collaborating on furniture with the Eames, Lily was there too, sitting on the chairs, sharing her critiques. Oh, I should mention by this point, they were married. They were married on June 10th, 1939, and they had two kids, Eric Saarinen, born 1942, and 3 years later, they had a little girl, Susan Saarinen.
Whoa.
Just like that.
I mean, all of a sudden, they're married with kids. That was so fast.
Yes. So cute.
In 1947, Lily was part of the award-winning team for the design of the St. Louis Arch, which, if you haven't, you should listen to episode 46 to learn about the fiasco that happened when they told someone else erroneously that they had won, but they didn't.
Oh, right.
Yes. OMG. It's all coming back now. A Steve Harvey moment for buildings.
Okay, but wait. So Lily was one of the designers of the St. Louis Arch? That's what you're saying?
I am. She was part of the team.
So cool.
Oh, okay. Now that's awesome. Also, St. Louis Arch, iconic.
The gateway to the West.
She did like some sculptures, and part of her contribution were sculptures that got removed from the final design, unfortunately.
Oh, sad.
I know. But she was still part of the team. So during this time, Lily wasn't working on as many sculptures as she was used to. We know this lady was intense. But now she was a mom, and she was juggling a lot more. Still, she was working. She was winning competitions with her husband. She had another commission with the architecture firm SOM for a space they were designing, an enameled bronze sculpture on the Mississippi River. She was keeping busy.
Again, casual commission with SOM. Even when she slows down, she's still doing cool things.
Yes. I know this season's about duos and partnerships, but I like that she was finding projects outside of her partnership with her husband.
Mm.
That was pretty cool.
Ooh, yeah, I like that observation. In the 1940s, Lily worked on the sculptures of the Crow Island School in Winnetka, Illinois. The architects who we know today as Perkins and Will, along with Eliel and Arrow Saarinen, worked on this project with Lily. Lily was asked to decorate the walls for young children and teenagers. So the architects would say where they wanted the sculptures, and the bricklayers would leave niches for the sculptures to be inserted. But she wasn't an afterthought. She knew way beforehand. She was involved in the schematic design. She would be given blueprints and discuss with the architects where the sculptures would go and what they would be, what they would be made out of, the finishes, the look, everything. It was designed all together, the sculptures. It was a part of the architecture.
That's really cool. I like that she was integrated into the design process rather than like, oh, we made these niches, put your sculpture here, you know, and hired after the fact.
Mm-hmm. It was the Saarinen way. Like, even Elia and Loya designed that way, and I love it. It just makes it all flow together.
She thought about how the children would engage with the sculptures, how low to the ground they would be, what they would be. She settled for different animals, pigs, cows, horses. Each classroom had doors that opened to the outside, to little courtyards, and each courtyard would have a sculpture. Lily made sure the scale of the sculptures were low, so children could engage and touch them. And they were brightly colored so that the children would find them interesting.
I really appreciate the thought she puts into the sculptures and like who's going to be interacting with them.
Yeah, because let's be real. A sculpture in a school is going to be climbed on and messed with. So you might as well plan for it.
Yeah, she's totally thinking like an architect. Don't you agree?
For sure.
Oh, yeah.
On a story that is all too familiar, Lily barely ever got any credit for her work. It would just not get recognized as an important part of the space. It will just fall under the umbrella of design by insert architect here. and that's it. Lily didn't realize it at the time, but as she grew older and thought about it, it really hurt her.
That's so sad, and even sadder that she realized in retrospect. Like, I wonder if in the moment she had pushed for recognition, if she could have made headway with it. But I'm sure in that moment, you're just excited to be working on a cool project and happy to be part of it, right?
Yeah, or they think it's just the norm at the time. Honestly, that's the bad side of, like, the Saarinen clan. The men got most of the credit, and I can understand that big firms that Lily partnered with could also overshadow her. But that's why telling her story now is so important.
Yeah.
100%. This is why we do it. Let me give you an example of what we're talking about. This project, Crow Island School, got a lot of buzz in the architecture community. She made 40 sculptures for this school, and there was zero mention of that. Her name was nowhere to be found. And listen to this. She was paid $500, and that's it. End of story.
No. Ugh. Okay, I'm really sad for her that that was the ending of such a cool and very well thought out and designed commission. And clearly it was well designed and well received if it got that much buzz.
Dang, those sculptures were cheap. Okay, jokes aside, that sounds terrible. Equal pay is a real thing, and it's a shame that she wasn't getting paid fairly.
Yeah.
Yeah. And no one ever really thought about giving her credit. All the architects were beyond pleased with her work and praised her in private. But unless you were in the know, you would have no idea who had anything to do with the sculptures. She says, "I think it was just thoughtlessness because they were the same way about the buildings. Arrow, particularly, you know, had all these people working for him. And as long as he paid them, he didn't think it was necessary to point out who did what. And that kind of thing, I don't want to dwell on because it's depressing. But it was natural. It was acceptable if you're paid for something. But I was only paid $500 for the whole lot."
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think this is a common issue with architecture and design in general, right? It's interesting to hear her talk about how Arrow was also perpetuating this in his own firm. But I think, like she said, it was thoughtlessness and just how things were done. It doesn't make it acceptable at all, but I do think a lot of times, starkitecture, like, that's what happens, right? Even today.
Yep. And it's also like the fog of the starkitect, right? Like, we all know that it isn't one person that makes the buildings. It's a team of people. It also reminds me of an idea that AIA president-elect and friend of the show Evelyn Lee had, like, that we should have an IMDb for buildings.
Oh, yeah.
Like, they have that for film and TV, where people who worked on movies, or in this case, buildings, can list their contributions. My cousin, who works on shows, says that she puts everything that she's ever worked on her IMDb page, even if she only bought coffee on set.
Really? I wonder how she knows that. Like, production assistant?
Production assistant for X Film, even if she was assisting in coffee.
In 1954, Lily and Arrow got divorced, and she moved to Cambridge, Massachusetts.
That's sad about her and Arrow, even though, I mean, we already knew that was coming since we already learned about his second wife, Aline, and how they met.
Yes.
Right.
I was wondering about this because things got a little saucy between Aline and Arrow while he was still married to Lily.
Poor Lily.
Yes. In her recounting, did she ever share her experiences during that time? Like, I always wondered if she had, like, suspicions or noticed things.
Not in the interview that I read. So I decided not to dwell on it, and I didn't look into it any further. We're just going to keep her private life private today. So, sorry. The tea shop is closed.
Fair.
The divorce didn't put a stop to her career. She carried on with her architectural sculptures. In the 1960s, she did one architectural piece for Franklin Street in Boston for the Harbor National Bank. It was a relief constructed with the slab system technique, which involved fitting pieces of her design in a kiln and transporting those to the site and then assembling them on site.
I'm glad that she kept on keeping on. Like, way to go, Lily.
Yes, that's awesome. I knew Lily would rise above any of that nonsense with her ex-husband. True. Plus, she was talented. We know this.
Yeah.
We know. During her lifetime, she taught at the Pratt Institute in New York City, MIT, and the Museum of Fine Arts School in Boston. And she won various awards, including the Rome Collaborative Competition, the A.H. Huntington First Prize, and the IBM Competition, to name a few. She passed away on May 22, 1995, at the age of 83.
Of course she decided to also teach, you know, as one does. Well, I'm very impressed with Lily and how she threw herself into whatever she took on. I can't wait to see pictures of some of her sculptures in the show notes, too.
Yes, agreed. I can't wait to see her work. Her story was so interesting, and she did so many things. Like, she was an Olympian.
Oh, I know. Like,
can't forget that.
All right. Now we have reached the second part of our episode, the caryatid. A caryatid is a stone carving of a woman used as a column or a pillar to support the structure of a Greek or Greek-style building. In each episode, we choose a caryatid, a woman who is working today, furthering the profession through their work, and who ties into the historical woman of our episode. Drum roll, please. Ada Tola.
Woo! Ada!
Yeah!
Ada Tola, along with her partner, Giuseppe Lignano, is the owner of the firm Lotec, which lives in the intersection between architecture and art. Through their practice, they explore ideas of sustainability, reuse, materiality in the built environment, and so much more.
Ooh, I already sense a connection with Lily.
Yeah, love to see it.
Ada and Giuseppe met when they were 16 in their hometown of Naples, Italy. They have been in professional practice together since 1993. Their first commission was to renovate a friend's apartment, and they used the opportunity to explore materials. A high percent of things they found around the site or just out about, they used it to construct their friend's apartment. They called this upcycling.
Wow, that's cool.
Yeah, I love watching videos on how folks, like, upcycle things. Any fans of the show Flea Market Flip, holla at me. I love it.
Woo-hoo! They convert standard 40-foot shipping containers into offices, bedrooms, and studios where people live or that are a part of exhibitions in museums all over the world.
Ooh, I love shipping container upcycling. They get a bad rep, but I think they're so cool.
Yeah, I really like the look. Their motto is, we start with the things we find. And they actually have a movie about their work with that same name.
Oh, can we watch it?
Oh.
Well, they have special screenings of it. Through their website, you're able to request an event. Ooh. I was wondering how to connect them with the Houston Museum of Art or maybe the AIA Houston. They might be interested. I need to put that in my to-do list. Talk to the AIA Houston president about screening the movie.
Yeah, that would be really cool.
Yeah.
If you want to find out more about this movie and how you can bring it to a screen near you, check out our show notes. We will include a link to their website.
Yeah, have a screening near you.
Ada and Giuseppe's collaboration and experimentation reminded me of Lily, how they all explore materials, scales, and user engagement of their designs. Just like Lily, Ada is also a professor. She currently teaches at the Columbia University, at Graduate School of Architecture, and she also taught at Syracuse. Though, I heard that through your ears. Though, it was before our time in 2005.
Mm. What? So we could have had her as a professor in another life.
Could have.
Aw, dang. Now that would have been cool.
Before we say goodbye, we want to say thank you to CMYK for the music, John W., our technical advisor, and most of all, thank you for listening.
Remember to check out our show notes for links to all of our resources on this episode, as well as pictures of projects we've talked about.
We hope you enjoyed learning about today's lady and caryatid along with our banter, and that you are inspired to find out more about them and other amazing professional ladies.
Please let us know what you thought of our episode. If you've enjoyed it, please help us spread the word. Tell your friends, colleagues, sisters, and brothers, and tell them to give us 5 stars on iTunes and Spotify, and write us a review. This will all help us reach a wider audience and for more people to learn about these amazing ladies with us.
Your support means everything to us. If you've enjoyed our content and want other ways to help us with our mission, you can support us by visiting our website for merchandise.
If you don't need any more swag, but you'd still like to consider supporting the research we're doing, you can donate to us on our website, shebuildspodcast.com/donate. Or you can buy us a coffee at buymeacoffee.com/shebuildspodcast. You can also find links to all of these items on our website.
She Builds Podcast is a member of the Gable Media Podcast Network. Gable Media is curated thought leadership for an audience dedicated to building a better world. Listen and subscribe to all the shows at GableMedia.com. That's GableMedia.com.
We're excited to hear from you and for you to come back and keep learning about bosses with us. You can email us your thoughts at SheBuildsPodcast@gmail.com. Leave a comment on our website at SheBuildsPodcast.com or follow us on Instagram and Facebook at SheBuildsPodcast and on X at SheBuildsPod. Until then, see ya.
Bye.
Bye.
That's offensive. Sorry. I just feel like when you say a comment like that, that's what you sound like.
Wait, what?
It's offensive.
Because your accent is so thick.
That's offensive.
I can do it again.
Get your voices together.
Yeah, I'll stick through.
I also like, though, that they don't have accents, even though the whole point is, like, his accent is thick. That was sort of my point about his voice being, like, the way you said it, because you were like, and it's like, oh, yeah, that Finnish guy who talks like he's from farmland America, like...
Talks like freaking Morgan Freeman. My son.
I don't know what Finnish people sound like in English.
Not that.
Hey there, architecture enthusiast. Nikita Reed here, inviting you on an incredible journey through time and space with my podcast, Tangible Remnants. Historic preservation and sustainability? Let's go ahead right now and debunk the myth that they are opposites. In fact, they are two sides of the same coin, shaping our collective future.
In a work environment, it has been challenging because I've had to probably do more than double just to make sure that I quote unquote fit in. But the environments that have allowed me to do me on the front end, I've been extremely successful.
You look at all these PhDs, they've built that on the backs of our elders.
Absolutely.
What they consider themselves to be experts at is what they've worked with us to achieve.
I know we have to prioritize people before products and before place.
Join me as we unravel the stories of historic buildings shaped by the people of a specific era and often influenced by race and gender. These tangible remnants are windows into our past and guideposts for the future. Follow the link in the show notes to subscribe now to Tangible Remnants. Let's explore the interconnectedness of architecture, preservation, sustainability, race, and gender.